This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today, Matt and Brett today. Once again, coming to you from the palatial and beautiful basement in my house. Yes, behold the magic of wood paneling. Once again, if you didn't know, I had a hip replacement surgery. I can't really drive because I'm taking the loopy drugs. And so until I can drive, I basically am doing the show here. Good news, Brett, though. I got some good news for you. I might be able to, I think by mid next week, I'll probably be coming into the station again. So,
oh, we already switched the locks so you wouldn't come back. No. We thought this would be permanent.
Hello. Let me in. I've got to do a show.
Oh, man, it's so nice this week.
Oh, gosh. I got to believe the scent is – I mean, the funk that was in that studio has got to be aired out at this point. Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, but hopefully the case – this the thing which is amazing, and we've talked about this, I still can't believe how good this sounds. I mean, it's not like we had, you know, Johnny Engineer come in and hook this up for us. This is basically you and I – bubblegum prayers and a microphone, and guess what? It doesn't sound bad me coming from the basement here.
I get you a Marty system if you want instead.
I do not want. We can't explain the Marty system. It's basically, oh gosh, they were horrible. They were horrible. I have so many funny stories of trying to broadcast from sporting events, particularly with a Marty system, and it just never worked. It just never did.
I picture you trying to tell your family to climb everywhere to try to place the thing in the right place because you can't do it.
Oh yeah, I could. There's no way I'd have to do it on the back porch and like then take down three trees. That's not going to happen. Well, good news is we got this, and this has been nice, and I appreciate you guys accommodating me because, once again, that hip was killing me. No, and I actually had someone finally ask the question. I was wondering how long this was going to take. Did I hurt my hip walking on all those walks I did last year? Now, a reminder, when pandemic started up, we started going to the parks, my family and I, and we started hiking. We did a calendar last year. We have done another calendar. It's coming out. I'll get you more details here in a little bit. But we got another calendar that's coming on out. And so but I did a lot of hikes. And sometimes I'd hike, you know, a good distance, 4 or 5 miles once or twice. And no, it had nothing to do with that. Quite literally, I think the only reason I didn't have to get the surgery done earlier was because I had been doing so much walking. And I had been, you know, going out to these parks and getting out and being active as much as I possibly could. I think that prevented me from having to get the surgery earlier. But no, I actually had arthritis in the hip. I mean, just in where all the soft tissue's gone and it's just bone on bone and delightful. And as a matter of fact, when I had my checkup yesterday, the guy sort of says, well, how's it feeling? It's like, well, it feels better than it did at this point when I was before I had the surgery. So that's a pleasant plus. So I did go for a walk today, my first walk outside in 2 weeks, basically. I went for a hike. Just going a block, I was exhausted. So it's going to be a while before I get back into the parks at the same level I was at. But I'm hoping to get back out there before too long. 952-946-6205. Brett, do you like milk? You know, the delicious white beverage that we have primarily for white people. It's the white beverage you find in the dairy section of your local grocery store. Do you like milk?
Yeah, it was depending on which meeting you were going with. But, yes, I do like milk.
Not love milk, but you like milk.
Oh, man.
You know, if you had to love milk, then you still probably wouldn't be like this one woman. There is apparently CNN had a woman on. In the morning anchor with Brianna Keeler, tweeting a quote from an individual who's profiled in a segment on high grocery prices. Now, by the way, I should mention, grocery prices are higher, but one of the things that's fascinating is actually salaries have increased at a higher rate than regular inflation for the first time in decades. So it's actually people are getting paid more and inflation's there. Not saying that everyone is, but, I mean, a lot of people are, you know, you're starting to get better return. So here's the quote, and I want you to just sit back and soak this one in like milk. A gallon of milk was $1.99. Now it's $2.79. When you buy 12 gallons a week, 4 weeks, that's a lot of money. Okay. And this is needless to say, if you've been online and you've had a few friends, including myself, who have all of a sudden been talking about milk, it all tracks back to this one quote from CNN. Now, first of all, I will say this as a person who's been grocery shopping in my family for years. When was the last time milk at $1.99 a gallon? This is one of those things where she clearly is trying to attack Joe Biden. And so it's like, milk was a quarter and now it's $2.79. Kind of, I'm exaggerating, but it's there. I mean, it's, you used to be able to buy a brand new car for a nickel, and now, thanks to Joe Biden, it's $35,000, damn it. You know, it's kind of one of those things. I don't know where your base pricing point is, but it's not been $1.99 for a while, not on milk. But it's the quantity of milk here we're talking about. Now, she does have a larger family. Okay. I remember when I was a kid, I was one of seven kids. I'm the youngest of seven, something you don't see a lot of anymore today, but it was, you know, a fairly common back then. In the 60s, 70s, you'd see, four, five, six, seven kids. I think we went through like a gallon of milk once every day and a half, maybe once a day. And that was with five boys, two girls, and, you know, they would just, we just chug right out of the gallon, too. It was, there was not a lot of, you know, royalty or formality to the whole process. But, at worst, we probably were one full gallon of milk per day. We are still 5 gallons down for the entire week than this woman apparently is at. And then she does this for her. Dear Lord, what is your cholesterol count? I'm hoping that's skim. God forbid it's whole milk. Dear.
She might as well get a few cows at that point if she's getting.
Yeah, have you thought about, maybe going to a source? Are your kids coming up to you? Mom, I don't want any more milk. Seriously, 40? Could you? I don't want to encourage this. Remember that I had that radio station, though, and people guzzling water, and someone died, unfortunately, because of this. I don't want you even encouraging this. But could a person drink 48 gallons of milk in a month and live? Oh my God, you're having to drink a gallon every day. You would have to be a gallon and more than a half, like three fifths, a gallon and three fifths every single day. Now, if you didn't have anything else, you might get up through it. I got to believe it's not going to be the healthiest diet you ever had. But we have a gallon of milk now. I've got two kids now and we do drink milk differently now. Brett, how often do you have a big old glass of milk?
Not that often. I'm not just usually sitting down and having one big old glass of milk. No, maybe a couple times a week at most.
Well, I notice I'll do it when I have a bigger breakfast. Like I'm getting, like pancakes or like this. Sometimes I'll have both a milk and a juice. I'll kind of sit down sometimes with this. I'm with you. I can't remember the last time I said, I'm going to have milk. That's not one that comes up too often on the menu choice. But that is different. We used to drink more milk back then, I think we did at least. But at the same time, today I think we get a gallon of milk. I've got two kids in the house still. That will probably last us a week, maybe a week and a half. They just don't drink it like they used to. At least in this woman's house, my God, it's like it's a slip and slide in the living room. Put the funnel in. Here comes another gallon. Oh, God.
Your kid said a bad word. You're going to get a glass of milk.
Something tells me every one of this woman's kids is going to walk out of that house and never come back again. Never have another glass of milk. They're going to go like past the dairy aisle and go into, have an episode. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Hey, Brett, you know who Scott McFarlane is, right?
Rings a bell, but the
NBC. He's the NBC4 Washington investigative reporter. He's the guy in Washington D.C. that's been put on the cases for all the January 6th defendants. And he's covering all these court cases in the D.C. Circuit Court as they're coming up. And he has been brilliant. I cannot recommend more to follow Scott McFarlane, because just because the volume of court cases this guy is able to follow, and he's able to keep you up to date on all of them. He can remind you of ones he's been to before, go through it. So you have a case where you know he's out there on a pretty consistent basis. He had a long thread today in regards to the case of Glenn Croy, who pleaded to misdemeanors. Croy unlawfully entered the Capitol twice and treated the U.S. Capitol like an amusement park, recording videos of mobs and rioters defacing historic statues. They're seeking 2 months in jail. Prosecutors argued Croy was part of a line of people in a mob who forced police to retreat further, and video recorded images complex, including the historic bust of Churchill, upon which someone put a MAGA hat. Feds allege Croy told a friend on January 9th, "I don't regret it needing to be done. It felt good to let them see what their Antifa thugs have been making Americans across country feel good, to let them know we're fed up." And it's interesting he brought that up back then, because to a point, this is something that has been brought up a few times. And it's been not only brought up through Scott McFarlane's fantastic coverage of this, but you'll hear a lot of Republicans make the comment, "Well, when are they going to go after those people from last summer where they were trying to steal a tube of toothpaste from a Target? They were mobs and they busted a window. When are they going after them?" And there's this real nasty, clearly the implication that you don't need to see through the mysterious maze here on is that why aren't they going after black people harder than they're going after us for storming the Capitol? And it's to a point as well, if I can say, I have been incredibly disappointed that the Democrats, especially the ones that have been calling for these prosecutions, haven't done a better job of explaining the difference between what happened on January 6th and what happened in Minneapolis and around the world this last summer. Because if you don't get it, and I want to get back to this Croy case today, because the judge in the case today made the point. My experience with, and this is going back a little bit here, Judge Hammer's defense of the claims that summer 2020 protesters didn't get punishment. In raised voices, she cites 2020 cases she's handled. For people who say they thought people who participated in protest in summer of 2020 got no punishment, that wasn't the experience in my court. My experience with prosecutions in summer 2020, people were brought to me facing felony charges, not counting the D.C. Superior Court cases, not the misdemeanor count cases that these 1-6 guys are. Judge doesn't want defendants bringing amendments, arguments that summer 2020 protesters got more leniency than January 6th defendants. The judge says, and here it is, "What happened on January 6th was a totally different category than the 2020 protest cases." She says they were trying to stop democracy itself on January 6th. And he goes on to say a few more from the D.C. chief judge. And there it is. When you have over the holidays that uncle, cousin, aunt, grandmother, grandfather, family, who comes at you and says, "Why didn't they go after those people in the summer of 2020 when they were protesting?" The black people. First of all, you can say, funny story, in Minneapolis, a lot of the people who were causing the biggest problems weren't from Minneapolis, nor were they black. And yet we have prosecuted quite a few of those guys, and they've gotten harsher penalties. But let's just get back down to the nuts and bolts of your standard conservative. Your standard conservative looks at a video footage of a black guy stealing a tube of toothpaste from a Target store and says, "Hey, I just went into the Capitol to basically try to overthrow a legitimate election by threatening to hang the vice president of the United States and defecated all over everything and was threatening to storm the House and the Senate and try to get hostages as far as senators and representatives. That's all I was doing. I didn't steal a tube of toothpaste." They don't even see it. what they did, I mean, and it gets to a point, and I don't want to take a far less important thing and try to put it up at the same level, but it is about the best way to criticize this. People have always looked at baseball and they say, why when baseball, when you have someone who's repeated drug offenses, why is it they don't hold them to a harsher standard than they did with Pete Rose? Why, people were wondering why you don't, you, why would they go after Pete Rose? Because what Pete Rose did was challenge the legitimacy of the sport itself. He, his actions in gambling on games he was managing brought to question whether or not any of those games were legitimate. Some guy taking drugs is bad, but the damage they're generally doing is to themselves, not to anyone else. That's why, as well, by the way, it's an absolute disaster Major League Baseball did not go after the Houston Astros and Boston Red Sox for cheating when they were caught red-handed cheating. Because if you don't penalize that, then you are basically turning your sport into wrestling, professional wrestling. And I'm not saying people don't get hurt occasionally in professional wrestling, but it's scripted. And that's all you have. You don't have a game. You don't have an athletic competition where the doubt of what's going to happen is up in the air. You have a scripted product. That is why you have to treat these people differently. This wasn't a tube of toothpaste. And I'm not saying we start allowing people to steal toothpaste from Target stores. But the fact that you think to yourselves, a Republican, a conservative, thinks to themselves, someone grabbing a tube of toothpaste at a Target store in Minneapolis during the George Floyd uprising is worse than somebody trying to overthrow democracy and install Donald Trump as the president. Herefore, ending democracy as we know it, because as I said, you will never be able to walk that back. You would never be able to walk that back. There is no way in the world you could have another election in 2024 and saying, well, this time we're going to let things stand. No, you could never walk it back. That was the Republicans basically saying we are going to throw out democracy as it existed and install Trump because we can't win unless we cheat. And it's even getting to a point where it's hard for us to win with cheating. So we're just going to scrap the whole system and start installing people because we just don't want the Democrats to win. If you can't see the difference here in destroying American democracy as itself, as it is, and some guy taking a lollipop from the cash register area of a Target store. If you can't see the difference between the two of those, then you don't want to see the difference. And it makes you a bias and it makes you an idiot. We used to, at one point, when people threatened the foundations of this country, rally together and say, that is not allowed. That is not tolerated. Instead, today, you've got people out here who are out making these arguments about how, oh, this wasn't that bad. Why didn't you go after the black people in Minneapolis far harsher? How come? How come? Let me make sure you understand how I feel about this. It was heartbreaking to see my city explode like that. It was heartbreaking because you saw what the police had become, murdering a man in the middle of the street. And the city had had enough of how the black people in this community had been treated. They'd had enough. And it was hard to watch what happened. And indeed, I have no problem with people that have committing crimes at that point being held accountable. That is not in question. But if you want to know how I feel compared to the people on January 6th, I want to make sure we understand very clearly. Green, this is Marjorie Taylor Greene, meet with those accused of taking part in the January 6th insurrection on what's called Patriot Wing of the D.C. jail, and on Friday morning went on to rant about the conditions the facility housing men, who she claims rushed out to meet me with cheers screaming down their faces. She made several attempts to mend the jail, and now, after having visited, claims she's going to move to the forefront on the issue of prison reform despite not serving any committees where legislation is hammered out. We toured the D.C. jail. My staff and I are willing to report the full this morning on our three-hour-long tour I've never seen human suffering like I witnessed last night. While some were shown to us seemingly beneficial programs, others were in torturous lockdown. Some inmates were receiving continuing education classes. Others were truly suffering from long stays in solitary confinement for bad behavior. I'll never forget hearing their screams. Tell you what, Marjorie, make a tape of those screams. Make a tape of these people's screams. Give me a copy. I'll listen to it over and over and over again. I don't have a lot of patience for someone who has allowed our prison system, which is freaking atrocious, to exist in the current state as it is right now until white people who like Donald Trump get put into it. But if you're asking if whether or not I feel bad for those people, oh, dear Lord, no. I would love to watch them cry. I would love to hear them scream. Give me a tape of that, because traitors to America do not deserve leniency. And that's all those people were. Traitors to America. If you can't see the difference between what happened in the wake of George Floyd in 2020 and the traitorous jackasses that tried to overthrow our government on January 6th, you don't want to, and I don't want you anywhere near me. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I have zero tolerance for the people. I mean, it's clear at this point that that's exactly what it was. This was Donald Trump's Hail Mary attempt. They spent the weeks after the election in 2020 trying to twist the arm of every Republican they could in the states where it was close to try to get them to overthrow. And at no point did they have any evidence of any wrongdoing. And they just basically were screaming at the top of their lungs. And, you know, the whole point was, it clearly seems to be that the point was to get as many of the people there on that day while they were counting the ballots and have them storm the Capitol. And at the very least, maybe they can get the ballots and destroy the ballots and then throw the whole process up in the air. And the point, and one thing that should not be missed, is that Nancy Pelosi very quickly saw that if they did not get back into session fairly quickly, that, I don't know, a Justice Alito from the Supreme Court, who seems to have his name keeps popping up in this whole case. I mean, people seem to have been in contact with him. That's at least the allegation I have seen. And trying to get Alito to put a hold on the election recount. And so Pelosi, realizing that if we don't get the House back in session immediately, then there's going to be, you know, there's this window of possible of you know, some other plot coming to light. She very quickly got the House back in session, got the Senate back in session as well, and they tried to stall at that point, but it was too late. And I want to remind everyone of the Republicans today who sit there and they say about January 6th, they say, oh, they were tourists. It was nothing that bad. No, those Republicans were scared to death that day. Lindsey Graham came on out and said, I'm done with this. You have Republicans fortifying the doors, trying to prevent these crowds from getting in there. It was clear, and it's also crystal clear, that there were traitors to this country in the House and the Senate who went along with this. This is why, in my mind, I am getting madder and madder by the day at Merrick Garland, because, my God, there seems to be copious evidence that something was going on, and at the very least, he, as the Attorney General, could get out there and get this information. It doesn't seem to be too speedy to do it. But we actually have to hold these people accountable, because this isn't a tube of toothpaste at a Target store. This isn't a minor infraction. You were trying to destroy American democracy as it was. And if they would have succeeded, elections would never have mattered again. I'll put that in perspective. they would have seated Trump until he decided he didn't want to do it anymore. And then they probably would have seated one of his kids until they didn't want to do it anymore. And then they would have seated another one of his kids. They would have eventually come on back and said, well, we can't trust the election system as it is anyway. So any Democrat is now illegal because we can't determine if Democrat votes are legal or not. So we're going to just call all the Democrats. So all of a sudden, the House and the Senate is 100% Republican. We would be a wildly different country. People in 100 years are going to look back on that January 6th because that was a moment. I kept saying to them as that was going on, I said, why aren't you shooting these people? And I don't take that lightly, but this was an attack on our Capitol. Why are you not starting to drop them like flies? And they should have. And they should have, in my mind, they should have shot more than one of them. No, this was an attempt to overthrow American democracy itself. And the saddest part is through 30 years of brainwashing from far right wing media in this country, you have people who are more than willing to throw to the side democracy for fascism because the idea of them losing elections is so upsetting for them that they would rather just get rid of the entire process and start installing their evil dictators as they like. That's the scary part. And the other thing that's terrifying, too, it is terrifying how close they came. If not for Mike Pence, if not for Nancy Pelosi re-adjourning the House, if not for the decisions of a handful of people, the governor of Maryland, the Republican governor of Maryland, the Democratic governor of Virginia, sending in the National Guard saying, if you guys aren't going to defend the city, then we are. A handful of people saved American democracy that day. And I will never forget the anger I felt when Donald Trump finally showed his face at the end of that day. I love you. It's time to go home. You gotta go home. I love you. Yeah. Traitor to this country. Traitor to this country. Every single one of them. And it's about damn time we stop allowing them to. Why didn't you go after the black guy last summer? Why didn't you? Well, no, a lot of people have been prosecuted for crimes from what happened in 2020. But if you think at any point the criminal acts of those people are anywhere close to what you clowns tried on January 6th, you're fools. God bless the United States of America. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's get into the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. COVID update from Minnesota Department of Health includes 3,378 new reported cases, 35 newly reported deaths. The state's COVID-19 death toll is now 8,828. As of November 3rd, the state reported that 3,481,580 people had received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. 3,326,854 people had completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 504,299 third dose booster shots. Yay, go team, go. Through November 4th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 982. That is down almost 40 from the number reported on Thursday. Thank God. I mean, I'll get to that in a second. That was, we haven't had numbers like that in a while. Of those hospitalized, 235 people are in intensive care, 474 in general hospital care. It does sound like we had talked yesterday, there was one bed available in northwestern Minnesota, one bed available in South Central. It does sound like they've gotten some more open beds, which is a good news. But still, I mean, we are literally at the point where the health system of this state is being strained to capacity. And the question has to start coming in is, what happens if this gets worse because people are still too stupid to get damn vaccinated? Ugh. The 3,378 positive results on Friday were from 50,578 completed tests. Test positivity rate of 6.68, which has actually been better, but it's still nowhere near the 5% rate where we need to be at. Any hope that a two-week stretch of declining hospitalizations in Minnesota was a sign of the current COVID wave had peaked and gone as hospital admissions have reached a new high for the ongoing surge. The Minnesota Department of Health reported 121,000 hospitalizations yesterday, including 232 in intensive care. That exceeds the previous high of 1,008 reported October 15th and the highest since there was 1,048 December 23rd. This latest wave, do not underestimate the fact people are like, oh, it's not as bad as last year. Yeah, it is. It is as bad as last year. Current hospital capacity is extremely limited. 49 staffed ICU beds available statewide. After a brief dip in mid-October, cases have once again been rising in Minnesota, with the majority of those continuing to come from greater Minnesota, where vaccination rates are typically lower and people are less likely to observe COVID mitigation efforts, a.k.a. freaking idiots. And I'm not saying all people out there are. A lot of people out there have been vaccinated. But yesterday we talked. There's still two freaking counties that are below 50% vaccination rate. I ain't gonna do that. Oh, shut up. I don't want you dead. I don't want you sick. I don't want you bankrupt. And I don't want you to have a lifetime worth of health problems. That's my stance. You're on the other side of that. Get vaccinated, you fools. Jeez, why does it take personal tragedy for you to actually all of a sudden, maybe I was wrong. Really? Why? Hospital capacity, which is affected by ailments of all kinds, including ongoing surge in children, the RSV surge in children, and critical staffing shortages, is just shy of its lowest point of the pandemic, which was set last month when the state was down to 45 staffed ICU beds. Got to remember, big difference between last year and this year, we don't have the Emergency Powers Act, so we don't have those emergency ICU units ready to go. And so without them, we don't have that extra capacity, so we're basically, is what we've got is what we got unless we get another emergency, emergency conditions put into place. Hospital capacity is tight. November 3rd, we reached 2021 high for COVID-19 hospitalizations. Only two other days when our current surge surpassed 1,000. For context, we had 1,864 COVID hospitalizations on November 29th, the Minnesota Department of Health said in the statement to bring me the news. We continue to monitor the situation and work with our regional healthcare preparedness. So right now we are, when you look at yesterday where it was 1,021, it still is well shy of the 1,864, but that's not a challenge. That's not a freaking dare. We know the vaccines work. We know. If you're one of these people that keeps saying, people are dying, where are all the freaking mass bodies, man? You're just pathetic. It's just Trump told you to not like him, so you just, I've done my own research. And we got the king of doing your own research coming up here in a second. In October, the state made moves to ensure adequate hospital capacity COVID-19 patients by freeing up space in long-term care facilities for continued care of patients transitioning out of hospitals. Minnesota Department of Health is reminding people to remain vigilant during the holidays by getting COVID-19 and flu vaccines. I've gotten both of mine. Speaking of consequences, a month after Disney's Aladdin shut down on Broadway because of breakthrough COVID-19 infections, two Twin Cities playhouses have canceled performances because of the pandemic. Artistry in Bloomington announced Thursday that it's scratched a week of performances and pushed back its opening of Little Women, the Broadway musical, initially scheduled for Thursday, November 11th, because of COVID-19. Little Women? Oh, a musical? Okay. The good news is because we are so vigilant with testing and protocols, we found out early it's just one person, we think. Artistry Executive Director Kevin Ramich said everyone was tested and our staff did a whole bunch of cleaning to be as thorough as possible. Good for you. Those with tickets canceled performances can exchange them for future performances. On Wednesday, Chanhassen Dinner Theater canceled its evening performance of The Music Man because an actor was unwell. Performances resumed on Thursday. We had a two-show day and around 6:05, one of the cast members was feeling a bit ill. Chanhassen spokeswoman Chris Howland said, our protocol is to send everyone home and test everyone, which we did out of an abundance of cautions. At this point, the tests were inconclusive, but we're treating it seriously. Good for you. Bravo. Seriously. Bravo. And that's not just for the plays. Although now I am kind of fascinated. How did you make a musical out of Little Women? But bravo. Nicely done. Take it seriously. And, you know, yeah, there are some places. You go to Texas and Florida. So I don't care if you're sick. Go out there and perform. People paid money for this. I'll tell you what. Let's take a break. Because this is the next story. It's part of the COVID. It's part of sports. It's Aaron Rodgers, the Packers quarterback. He had a lengthy rant today on something called the Pat McAfee Show, talking about him currently, and if you don't know, he is currently benched for safety protocols with COVID. And it sounds as if he had kept telling people, I am immune from this disease. And the NFL is like, no, you're not. And so the NFL had considered him unvaccinated. And so he's going through protocols. He's a little bit miffed right now. We'll talk about Aaron Rodgers when we do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. All right. So the rest of this hour, I want to talk about this. We have a problem here, and we're not a sports show, and I don't necessarily like talking about sports too much because there is already a lot of people, and frankly, I have a lot of people that are very good sports people that know their sports inside and out in this town who are very good at that. But I do talk about it when sometimes it crosses over into the public realm, and especially in the case where we have to, once again, we've create these gods, especially for our kids, and that because the person can throw a football or can shoot a hockey puck or is really good at hitting home runs, and we turn these athletes into these you know uber humans. And the reality is that we got to be careful of who exactly we give our praise to. And we've already talked about this when what's the name? I'm zoning on our tub of paste quarterback for the Vikings. All of a sudden,
Guy Kirk Cousins.
Kirk Cousins, that's right. We ripped on him when he basically said we're not going to get this vaccine. We're not going to get vaccinated. He didn't say it like that, but he wasn't getting vaccinated. Dude, you've got a responsibility to the community. And you shouldn't be out there basically making health decisions, which you are. You want people to listen to you when it comes to buying a freaking pizza or who to get buy insurance from. But then all of a sudden you act as if, well, I don't have any responsibility when you go on out there and badmouth a vaccine. You can't have it both ways. You can't go on out there and say, you hire me because people do what I want them to do, and we'll sell a lot of garlic cheesy knots for your pizza place. But then all of a sudden say, no one cares if I don't get vaccinated. Yeah, they do. You have a responsibility. So Cousins aside, Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers also has proven he's kind of an idiot. He went on a lengthy rant today saying he's currently in the crosshairs of the woke mob that is pounding the final nail in his cancel culture casket after he emerged. Dude, man, I'm going to let you know. If you didn't want anyone to know what your political leanings are, you are clearly a Republican. I'm just going to say it. After it emerged, he is not vaccinated against COVID-19 after contracting the virus. Now, once again, I want to make sure I say this. I don't want the guy dead. I don't want the guy sick. He's not going to get bankrupt because he's wealthy, very wealthy. But at the same time, I don't want him sick. And this is, you know, this is a tragedy. But unfortunately, he feels as if, you know, like I say, my point is I don't want you dead. I don't want you sick. He's like, I'm going to show you the counterpoint. I'm like, really? There's a counterpoint. And he tried. Rodgers currently the NFL reserve COVID-19 list after testing positive coronavirus on a Wednesday. Because he's unvaccinated, he must sit out a minimum of 10 days, including the Sunday game against the Kansas City Chiefs. But the reason, I know it's the Chiefs, and I call them the Chiefs. A, we shouldn't be using Native American mascots. B, Chiefs is just too good. But the reason Rodgers, as he says, is in a crosshairs over public scrutiny is because he said before the season that he is immunized. Yes, he said he's immunized. Now, This would be an interesting thing because we just on Monday talked the story where the research has shown now that by getting vaccinated, you actually are 5 times more immune from coronavirus than if you actually get coronavirus and actually have anti-coronavirus antibodies in your system. It actually still is healthier to be vaccinated. I don't know exactly where Rogers got this idea he was immunized, but that's what he said. He never publicly shared that he didn't get the vaccine, which he says he avoided because he allegedly has an allergy to an ingredient used in the mRNA vaccines at Moderna and Pfizer and wasn't interested in getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because of concerns over the extremely rare side effect of blood clotting. I didn't lie in the initial press conference, Rogers claiming media members were on a witch hunt to find players who weren't vaccinated. At the time, my plan was to say that I'd been immunized. Well, you hadn't. So you lied. So stop your whining, you pathetic mule. Dear Lord. Rogers said he would have gone into further detail about his status had anyone in the media simply asked the follow-up question. Why would they need to ask? You said you were immunized. There is no need to a follow-up question. You said something that was a lie that was, there was no need to follow it up. Now, I guarantee you this. You think that there is anything that you can say that they're not going to follow up on now? They are. He goes on to say, I'm not some sort of anti-vax flat earther. I'm someone who's a critical thinker. I march to the beat of my own drum. I believe strongly in bodily autonomy and the ability to make choices for your own body, not to have an acquiesce to some woke culture or crazed group of individuals. By the way, mind you, the crazed group of individuals is the pretty much the entire medical field of the United States. The woke culture, I guess, is the 240 million or so vaccinated people in this country. Okay. Health is not a one-size-fits-all for everybody. He also went to cite Martin Luther King Jr. Oh, for God's sakes, you prophetic jackass. He quoted Martin Luther King Jr. during his eyebrow-raising appearance. Rogers said he spent as much time researching the vaccines as he did before he served as a guest host on the week of Jeopardy. He came to the conclusion that avoiding the vaccines were in his best interest. Okay, so wait a minute here. You went and did your own research. What does that mean? So you went and found some loon ball doctor who said, you need to take horse dewormer and put it up your backside. And did you believe that guy? As opposed to, I don't know, the American Medical Association, the Center for Disease Control, the Journal of American Medicine, the Mayo Clinic, John Hopkins. You're telling me that you want to do research. If you look at the research that's out there, and it's very well documented on the pro-vaccine side, and it comes from a plethora of sources. I mean, a plethora of sources, not only locally, not only nationally, and internationally. There is tons of people that have done research that have shown the vaccines are good, and they have the research to show it. They've done all these things. And on the other side of it is some crazed loon ball doctor who really wasn't very good at being a doctor and whose politics override everything else, sitting in their office and saying, I don't have any research on this, but this makes you magnetized. What's wrong with you? You didn't do research, because if you'd done research, the first thing you would say is, well, the vast majority of professionals in this field think that this is the way to go, so I better do it. You went and found people that validated your opinion and then called it research. Because, like I said, if you did actual research, what kind of research did you do? 2 or 3 minutes on Google? No, you didn't do research. You went out there and found people who you agreed with and basically used that as your counterpoint to pretty much the entire medical system of this country. But hey, that's what you call the woke mob, crazed group of individuals. He is also fearful that the vaccine could lead to sterility, suggesting even if he didn't have his allergy, this gives him pause to getting vaccinated. It doesn't. If you had done research, you dumbass, you probably would have seen that. Man, maybe we should put him on concussion protocol, too. No studies so far have been found any credible link between the COVID vaccine and being sterile, although there have been studies that suggest the actual virus itself can cause you to have sexual dysfunction. So there you go. If you've got sexual dysfunction now, you have no one to blame because you got COVID. Sorry. Boys aren't going to be working as strong as they were before. Your offensive line's going to be a little weaker. Rodgers then bemoaned the rules unvaccinated players must follow compared to the vaccinated. He said unvaccinated players are being made to think they're dangerous ones, then listed things he's doing every day to follow league protocol, which includes testing every day, social distancing. That's great, but you told everyone you were vaccinated, you were immunized, and you weren't. During his interview, Rodgers also admitted he'd taken the deworming medication Ivermectin, which has not been approved for use for COVID-19. But, of course, you know, you don't need the medical research on that if you want to put the horse dewormer up your backside. He said that the steps he took to treat his COVID came from consulting podcast host Joe Rogan, who, by the way, FYI, not a medical professional. Wow. You're an idiot. You're just a freaking idiot. And don't sit there and say this is everyone else. You lied. And you didn't do research. Your politics tried to drive you into doing one thing. And so you did what you think. And now you screwed up and you got sick. And now all of a sudden you're looking to point and blame everyone else. No. Rodgers, look in the freaking mirror. Blame yourself. And stop being an idiot. For a guy that hosted Jeopardy, how can you be this dumb, dude? Seriously. How can you be this stupid? There's more, but I'm done with that one. Hour two of the show. That comes next. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Matt, Brett, have you read that story yourself on the Aaron Rodgers stuff, the poor little pity party he's throwing for himself?
Yeah, what an idiot. And I know I texted you this too. Aren't the Packers supposed to forfeit? They have an unvaccinated player that got COVID. I thought that was the NFL protocol.
No, I think that if enough players get put on the COVID list, they have to forfeit because they can't just start adding players. So, and they can't just add, I think there is a limit to the amount of practice squad players that can play in a regular game. I think it's two. So it's kind of one of those things where if all of a sudden a large portion of the team is down, it's that I just, like I said, I mean, it's these guys think that they're clever, and there's nothing I think that's dumber than idiots that think they're clever. And he thinks that, well, I said I was immunized. Why didn't you ask the question? Because like he's somehow smarter than everyone else. But then it's like he gets to the point. It's like, oh, you took ivermectin. You took the horse dewormer stuff. Wait, where in the world can you show me any leading medical journal? Not one guy, and there was a person who was a nurse in Jamaica, and there is a German doctor, and you know, this kind of like legion of doom that exists of just horrible medical people. There are 20 of them that somehow you think override the American Medical Association, the Center for Disease Control, Journal for American Medicine, the Mayo Clinic. I mean, at what point do you think that we just don't see, oh, yeah, so you're a Trump fan and you basically decided that you weren't going to take the vaccine and now you're just frantically looking for a reason to validate your stupidity?
Yeah, he just Googled things I want to believe are true. That's probably what he ended up doing.
Warning for you, if someone steals something from you and you have the ability to kind of track where that is, you might want to do this and think that you can, you know, kind of go down the road of you know, vigilantism. You know, you don't want to. Yeah, death wish is not a how-to thing. A Brooklyn Park man is accused of tracking down a man he believed he stole his business's van, then shooting him. Christopher Nicholas Kilborn, 45, of Brooklyn Park, is charged. Now, first of all, I want to make sure we understand. This guy, Christopher, he was initially the victim because his van was stolen. And we all can agree, that's not right. That being said, he's charged with second-degree assault with a dangerous weapon in connection to the November 2nd incident. According to the criminal complaint, police responded to a shot spotter notification in the area of DuPont Avenue North and Lowry Avenue North in Minneapolis at about 7:50 a.m. that day. Before officers arrived, they received two 911 calls related to the incident, one about a man who was yelling outside and another from Kilburn, who said he had tracked down his stolen van and had the thief at gunpoint. A man could be heard in the background yelling, "Kilburn shot him." Charges said, "He shot me." Yeah, whatever. Get over here. When officers arrived, they found Kilburn standing over the victim, was lying face down on the sidewalk. Kilburn was holding onto the man's pants and belt, the complaint said. The victim had a large gash on his head and a gunshot wound to his hand. An officer took Kilburn's handgun from his front waistband. Kilburn told police the victim had burglarized. Now, first of all, he doesn't know that. He goes on, he says the victim burglarized his business. He doesn't know if the guy that he found in the van at that point was the guy that stole the van. It might be. I'm not saying it isn't. But this could be just some guy who said, "Hey, I got a job. Can you sit in my van? I need you to go over and pick up something." He doesn't know if this is real. If he's a victim. Charges led. He tracked his vehicle to North Minneapolis, saw the victim in the driver's seat, so he approached and pointed his gun at the victim, telling him to turn off the van. Kilburn said the victim looked like he wanted to run away, so he grabbed the victim and physically got him out of the van. The complaint says Kilburn made him face the van and told him not to move. The victim was struggling, so Kilburn said he hit him with the butt of a gun, so then you assaulted him. But the victim got away, so he chased him and yelled stop before firing one round at the victim. Because, you know, if you're out of shape and you can't run, Brett, you know, the best way to win a race is just to put a bullet right in the back of some guy, you know? That slows him down real quick.
No, you're not wrong. Well, not exactly a legal way to do it, though.
That's how they do races in Russia. I believe that's how they do it in America. He yelled stop before then shooting him. Kilburn said the victim then tripped and fell down, so he grabbed him and called 911. Are you sure he didn't fall down because you shot him? That could be the case. Kilburn was arrested and booked into Hennepin County Jail on November 2nd. He was released on November 4th. Jail records show he's scheduled to appear in court on November 29th. It's unclear if the man who he shot facing any charges for the alleged van theft. That's the point we need to make. He has no idea if the person he found in the van at that time was the guy who stole his van. So henceforth, and like I said, that could be completely an innocent bystander. His cousin calls up saying, "Hey, can you go? I got a van at my house. I'm going to give you a key. Can you run over and pick up something for me?" "Sure, I can do that for you." He doesn't know. This guy, for all he knows, thinks Kilburn's a psychopath that's trying to steal his gun, or steal the van, and try to take it from him. Not saying that the guy he shot is innocent, but this is why you don't just go on out there and death wish your way into this stuff, because you don't know who's innocent and who's guilty. And we also have this thing called courts, which, if you would arrest the guy, then he might be held. He might be found guilty. They could go to jail, and then you still get your van back. Now, I mean, I'm going to guess this. He's going to go to jail for how long, do you think? 4 years? 3 years? 4 years?
Yeah, he'll be locked up for at least a year, I would think.
At least. I mean, you wanted to be the tough guy. Well, don't do that. I mean, the minute he'd be able to track it down, I mean, that should have been, you know, you should have called the police. Now, once again, we're talking Minneapolis police, so whether or not we'll get back to you next Tuesday between the hours of 3 and 7 p.m. That might have been, the Xfinity appointment timeline could have been the thing he got from the Minneapolis police. But still, at the same time, that's you can't go in out there and do your own vigilante justice because, yeah, you're going to jail. And you can think you were in the right, but you do not have the authority to go out there and whack a guy in the back of the head with the butt. That had got to hurt. And then the question is this. You don't do that. You know why you don't do that? It's because it can go off. And you can fire around willy-nilly in any direction because you went and bashed on some guy's head. Dear Lord. Oh, I guarantee you, I can't wait for the Republican to come on out and say, he's the real victim here. Yeah, it usually goes that way. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Brett, you have a little, you do this little Friday thing where you get a nice little interview for us. Who are you talking to today?
Yes, we're speaking with Minneapolis attorney Larry McDonough. He's a nationally recognized expert on landlord-tenant law, as we're going to be talking about how Minnesota and really the entire country has been kind of using, I guess, lack of a better way to putting it, an off-ramp from a lot of these rental protections we had from COVID-19. So we'll touch a little bit on that and what resources renters have to protect themselves. It's a good conversation. In fact, we're not going to play the entire interview. The entire thing will be posted on the website just because we went a little long. But you'll get most of it here on the airwaves right now.
Nice member benefit right there. All right, so we got this is the full interview, the unedited interview. You can get online a little bit later on. I've got myself my Nan crisps and some hummus. I've got my dining ready to go here as we listen to Brett Johnson with one of his interviews right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back here with you. We're joined now by Larry McDonough. He is an attorney at the Housing Justice Center, as the website is hjcmn.org, as we are going to be talking about what the situation for renters is in Minnesota right now and possibly around the country. Because you might be aware that just a few weeks ago, we had some major changes as we're kind of taking an off-ramp to the eviction moratorium that we, of course, saw during COVID. But that has led to thousands and millions more of Americans nationwide that potentially could be facing evictions from their apartments and their housing situation. So, Larry, really glad to have you talk with me through this, because this is a very, very important topic that I think a lot of people need to hear, especially if you're someone who is behind on your rent. So, Larry, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's fun to be back. I was back on the show last year talking to Ellie about similar issues, and things have changed since then, so it's a good time to talk.
Absolutely, and you're referring to, you were a guest on Ellie 2.0 Radio about a year or a year and a half ago, and you can go back and check that out over at am950radio.com. So first question I have for you, Larry, what is the situation right now for renters in Minnesota? Because as I understand it, we had a major change that occurred on September 12th, just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, there've actually been major changes that have been going in stages over the last year and a half. So back on March 23 of 2020, Governor Walz signed an executive order that really stopped most evictions in the pandemic, and that executive order was changed a couple of times over that time period. And you might recall that, you know, our death rate and our infection rate a year ago was just really off the charts. And there was a lot of science out there that showed that having evictions slowed down in a pandemic was not only good for the economy, but also good for health and safety. That if you evict one tenant household, it's probably going to combine with another household somewhere else in a pandemic. And that could be in a tent, under a bridge, in a shelter, or doubled up in another house. And so by slowing down evictions, the evidence shows that we saved lives in Minnesota. And my own estimate of looking at medical journals from around the country and extrapolating from those models was that in 2020 alone, we probably saved about 2,000 lives, people that otherwise would have died because of that commingling that occurs when you have evictions. So evictions were really on hold pretty dramatically until the end of June this year, and then they have gradually opened up on an eviction transition law in different stages. And the most recent opening was actually October 12. There was an opening on September 12, but then there was another one on October 12. And so for the most part, evictions are kind of the right to file an eviction is where it was before the pandemic, with one important exception, and that's landlords cannot file eviction court cases for non-payment of rent against tenants with a pending state emergency rental assistance application. So for any tenant that's been behind on the rent, they should be applying. If they haven't already, they should apply at Rent Help Minnesota, and I can give you the website on that that we can discuss. But that's the important protection that's out there. Some of the other protections that we had earlier have gone away.
And I want to dive a little bit more into what you were just talking about, how if you at least have a pending application for rental assistance, you at least could be on hold for potentially getting evicted, because there is some really shocking news that I was reading about, that the vast majority of people who could be eligible for rental assistance, close to 90%, have not yet applied for assistance or are still waiting for a response. Talk a little bit about why that rate is so low, 90%. That's a pretty surprising number to me.
Yeah, well, the rate is low for several reasons. One, the agency that is handling assistance in Minnesota is the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And that's not a place that most people know. Its history is essentially a bank for housing programs and construction around the state. So it's kind of operated as a kind of state bank to help in the production of affordable housing. So when in the past, when people got behind on the rent and they maybe needed a little bit of assistance to either stay in their place or to move to a new place, they didn't go to this agency. They went to a county emergency assistance program. And those programs were great for small debts or small relocation, but they had limitations on how much they could spend. And so those agencies were not set up to pay maybe like 6 months of rent or a year's worth of rent or something like that. So when the federal law was passed as part of one of the stimulus packages to support this, it went to state agencies around the country. So the first problem is that most tenants had never even heard of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Second problem was that the Housing Finance Agency didn't have a history of running a program like this. Again, its work was more having funding available for someone who wants to construct a subsidized housing project, so a little more like a bank. And so they had to develop their own processes on how to take applications from individuals for an assistance program. The third problem was that there were a lot of kind of do's and don'ts in the federal law that set this up. And that's not a bad thing. And if you want to target money to go to a certain, you know, set of people, then you put a lot of kind of do's and don'ts. So it shouldn't go to these people, ought to go to these people. But the more of that you have, the more of a bureaucracy you need to make sure it's going to the right place and that you're not engaging or you're not victimized by someone who might be committing a fraud on the agency to have the money go somewhere else. So whenever you have a program that has a lot of kind of requirements around it, it's harder to administer and slower to administer. So when you put all these things together, we have people not knowing about an agency that's new to this kind of work and an agency that kind of had to figure out how to do it. And so that's not only slowed the applications to the agency, but it's also slowed the agency's response. And then we've also had kind of a gradual shift of guidance from the federal government on how the money ought to be used. And that's not inherently a bad thing. I think it's kind of loosening up some of the restrictions. But in doing so, that kind of makes all these agencies go, okay, wait a minute, we got to double check and make sure we're doing this right with the current guidance that we're getting from the federal government. So just in the same way that some people are a little confused by the federal guidance on health in the pandemic because that shifted, those shifts are not bad shifts, and I think they're actually good shifts based on science. We know more now than we did a year and a half ago. But that shifting of the ground, I think, makes people uneasy. So I think all that's added to low application rates and a slow payment response.
Yeah, that's interesting because I remember reading, I think it was in MinnPost a few weeks ago, how they were talking about a number of advocacy groups that were helping renters and talking about how tough it was to apply for that rental assistance that, of course, is available right now. And I think it is important to point out, as I know you were mentioning, that if you at least have that application on file, you can at least get a hold on an eviction, even if you're not seeing that money right away. Because as I imagine right now, there probably is a pretty big lag time from when you apply and when you actually start seeing that rental assistance go towards, well, paying your rent.
Yep. And one thing I want to make very clear is that having a pending state rental assistance application is not, it's not like a monopoly get out of jail free card. I mean, if I'm engaging in conduct that is a material violation of my lease by being, you know, violent or damaging property or, you know, running drugs out of my apartment or something like that, that pending application does not protect me from eviction. It does, so I still have to be lease compliant with the law. But if I am compliant with the law, the only issue the landlord has with me is that I'm behind in the rent. The landlord can't evict me for that reason if I have that pending application. And non-payment of rent historically was always the biggest percentage of eviction cases. Standing alone without any other claims, maybe 60 or 70% of the cases, or if in addition with another claim, some sort of violation of the lease, then we see non-payment of rent being a part of more like 90% of the eviction cases. So having this protection of a pending state emergency rental assistance application is a really important thing.
So I've not been a part of this process myself, but I'm curious about how this actually works. If it does get to the point where a renter is going to be evicted, what sort of documents or proof does the landlord need to show? And of course, on the renter side too, what do they need to show that, you know, saying, hey, I actually shouldn't be evicted? Or does it even often get to that point? Is there sometimes mediation between landlords and renters? I've always been kind of curious about that, especially, of course, obviously here during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yep. So there's no legal requirement for people to mediate, but mediation has always been a really good option for landlords and tenants. And there's a really nice kind of one-stop location to get connected with mediation programs. It's a group called Community Mediation Minnesota, and their website is communitymediationmn.org. And because there are different mediation programs around the state that kind of have different kind of, you know, turfs, and you can go to this one place and they can find you the mediation service that's in your area. It's always been a good thing for landlords and tenants to do it. I think in the past, maybe some landlords were a little less interested in it because they thought that might slow things down, because we have a very fast eviction process in Minnesota, faster than most states. But evictions are still a little bit expensive, $300 to file it. And if you have to use a number of the court and law enforcement services as part of that, you can get up to over $500. So it's not cheap to do this. So mediation has always been a good way, I think, for landlords and tenants to avoid having to have eviction cases. In the pandemic, I think landlords started to warm up to it more because under the executive order, they didn't have eviction as a remedy in most cases. It was very limited where a landlord could do an eviction case. They could do it in kind of where the allegations were kind of nasty, like, you know, significant property damage, endangering other people, drugs in the property, things like that. So I always encourage landlords and tenants to engage in that process. And even if that leads to a tenant leaving without a court case makes it easier for the tenant to find housing down the road. So that's a really kind of good way to go at this point. I think I might have forgotten the other part of your question.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I think you gave a good overview. Yeah, I was just curious about how that process, yeah, actually works. If it does, well, A, get to the point where it does reach a court case, and then B, you know, if there is mediation instead. No, I think you did a good job covering that. Go ahead.
Now I do remember you did ask about how do landlords, what do landlords have to prove and what do tenants have to prove in these kinds of cases? Right. And so, some of the courts are requiring landlords to show that they're in compliance with our eviction transition law. That's not uniform across the state. Different courts have done standing orders on what landlords need to prove in their cases, and others haven't. So if I were advising a landlord, I would say, if you're filing a case for nonpayment of rent, I think you need to determine if a tenant has a pending application for state emergency rental assistance, because you're not supposed to file that case if they have that pending application. So you should talk to the tenant. Now, if the tenant has applied, the landlord probably knows, because the process requires the landlord to verify that the tenant has a debt and for what period of time. But the tenant might be just in the early stages of the application process, and so the landlord might not know that the tenant has started that application. So I think landlords should talk to the tenant and figure that out. On the tenant side of the equation, if the tenant has a pending application, they should have an email from the program saying that they have a pending application. And if the case is for nonpayment of rent, they should bring that to court with them. Another thing that landlords and tenants probably don't know is the CARES Act from a year ago that's the act of Congress that set up those first expanded unemployment checks and also had an eviction moratorium as part of that. A lot of that act ended, but one part of it that didn't was the requirement that landlords of what are called covered properties have to give a 30-day eviction notice before they file any kind of eviction case for rent or anything else. So then you need to know, what is a covered property? Covered properties include kind of two categories. One are properties with federal subsidies, like public housing, different types of subsidized housing by either HUD or the Department of Agriculture. But the other category that would catch people by surprise is that landlords of properties with federally backed mortgages. Now, a lot of people don't know if their mortgage is federally backed. Like, I own a small home in St. Paul. I don't know if my mortgage is federally backed. Now, I don't need to know because I'm not a landlord at the moment. But if I were a landlord, I'd need to know. And a lot of people wouldn't know right away because their mortgage might have shifted hands several times. So a landlord needs to figure out, do they have a federally backed mortgage? Are they a covered property under the CARES Act? If so, they've got to give a 30-day notice before they even consider filing an eviction case. And if a tenant gets an eviction case, they need to figure out if their landlord is a covered property. Now, tenants could go to a legal aid office, those with lower incomes, and they'd be able to figure that out. I actually have some links on my website on how to find out if a property is a covered property. So there still are some complications here for both landlords and tenants in kind of figuring out, do they fit into a particular category of obligation or protection?
And final question for you here, Larry, and this has to do more with your opinion on what's happening right now, since you've obviously been working in housing and with renters for a number of years. Again, we are speaking with Larry McDonough. He's an attorney for the Housing Justice Center. Website is hjcmn.org. I'm curious about your opinion about the off-ramp program we have with Minnesota as we begin to sunset some of the protection renters have. If you could wave a magic wand, I guess, what would your ideal kind of program look for trying to get us on the path to where we no longer need these protections? Are we moving too fast or are we moving too slowly on this? I'm just kind of curious what your opinion is on that.
Yeah. We're moving too fast. And if you would have asked me back in July when the pandemic numbers were not as bad as they are now, I think I wouldn't have felt as strongly about it. I did some lobbying on this law, and I wanted it to be a longer transition than it is. But when you are lobbying, there are agreements that are made, and you have to kind of pick your battles. And so there was a lot of lobbying of the House House and Senate committees that were looking at this, and then ultimately they decided what they were going to do. I think that decision was based on pandemic numbers that were looking positive in June. In retrospect, I think it was premature for the governor to give up his peacetime emergency powers. I think we're at a point right now, I mean, the number of deaths yesterday, I think were maybe 40, 41 or something. And our positivity rate is over 6%. So there are a lot of things going on with the pandemic now that have nothing in common with where they were at in June and have much more in common with last fall and last winter. So I think it is going too fast. If I could wave a wand, I think I would move us backwards to more of the eviction protections that we had under the executive order and the very early stages of this eviction transition law. And who knows, we may get back there. I mean, the legislative session starts in January. You know, we'll see where the numbers are. You know, around the country, the news is that the numbers are going down, but that's not where we are right now. And when you look at the upper Midwest, states like Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Montana, our numbers are quite bad. And we're not locked into our houses yet we're not locked indoors when you look at last year, this was the bad time last year, starting this time of year and going into the late winter and early spring. That was the really nasty time for the pandemic. So I'm hoping that the governor and the legislature are able to kind of move us backwards if the numbers stay where they are now in January.
Yeah, you are unfortunately right that it was just about this time last year, kind of that late fall season where the numbers did begin to tick up. So hopefully that's not the case, but I think you might be right that we could be moving a little bit too quickly on this. Larry, a couple more final questions for you, actually. First, I want your contact information over for the Housing Justice Center, and I think it's also important to point out to people who maybe are struggling with their rent right now where they can go to make sure that they can apply for rental assistance if needed, if you can give us that information.
Yeah, so I'll give you a few things here. I have a website of my own that's separate from Housing Justice Center that has a lot of information on housing laws right now, and that's called Poverty Law, one word, .homestead, HOMESTEAD.com. It's a teaching website that I have, and I have slideshows and manuals and lots of information on what's going on with housing in general and housing in the pandemic. Now, if people are having trouble with evictions, tenants, they should go to, there's a website called Law Help MN, so LAWHELPMN.org. It's a website that's put together by a coalition of legal aid offices around the state, including the one where I used to work. And you can find information on housing law, but other types of other areas of law. And you can find the legal aid office closest to you to get help. Now, if you're looking at issues of applying for the state's Rent Help Minnesota program, the website for that is Rent Help MN, so RENTHELPMN.org. That's the website for making an application. You can also call 211. It has a helpline with a multilingual staff that can help people with those applications. Now, where I work is the Housing Justice Center of Minnesota, and its website is, I think we mentioned it earlier, it is, I've only been there a short time, so I'm still kind of remembering the website. So it's HJC for Housing Justice Center, HJCMN.org. And the last thing I wanted to mention is that at the Housing Justice Center, we have a program to help tenants who have been denied state rental assistance. And they might have been denied because they didn't do the application well. This is, again, complicated stuff, and for a lot of people with low incomes, doing applications online is challenging. So we have a program at the Housing Justice Center to help people with denials, and that help could be either helping them do a new application or helping them with an appeal. If they're doing an appeal, they only have about 10 days to do that, so the time period's pretty short. We have an 800 number at the Housing Justice Center to help people who've been denied state emergency rental assistance, and that number is 800-403-0476. So again, it's 800-403-0476.
Excellent. And we will make sure we get all of that information posted on the description of the interview, which will be over at am950radio.com. So you'll find all of that contact information, the phone numbers, and all of the websites that Larry mentioned over at am950radio.com. Either click on the Matt McNeil Show or the Best of Interview section, then you'll find the interview that we're doing right now with Larry, and you'll find all of that contact information. Again, we have been speaking with Larry McDonough. He is an attorney. He is with the Housing Justice Center, also an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law, talking a little bit about what the situation right now is for renters in Minnesota. Larry, really appreciate the time today. Lots of good information. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy that you're covering this because this is really important information, and we gotta get it out there and get more people aware of it. So thank you.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. I've been asked if we're going to do dancing today. I can't dance. I'm still recovering on the hip. I won't yet, so we won't be doing that. I will be doing it before too long, though, especially probably maybe 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today, I'll be in the studio, and we might be able to try to pull that off. We'll have to see.
We could do. I could move around the image on the screen and have it kind of go to the beat of the song, whatever you pick there.
Well, do you think it would capture my thunder? I don't think it would. I don't think it would. And I don't even want to know how you'd make me twerk. But I will. We'll save that for when the time when my medical advisor had said, okay, let's not do that. 952-946-6205. For the first 9 months as chair of the Minnesota House Commerce Committee, Representative Zach Stevenson wouldn't even hold hearings on bills to change state liquor laws or add the state to the growing list of those with legal sports betting. He was too busy, he said, drafting his chunk of the two-year state budget and moving a bill to legalize, regulate, and to tax recreational marijuana. But now, over 2 weeks' time, the Coon Rapids DFLer has heard more than two dozen bills to liberalize liquor regulation, and on Tuesday announced that he would be the lead sponsor of a sports betting bill that, if adopted, would make Minnesota the 33rd state to legalize betting on games since the 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruled invalidated federal laws banning it from all but a few states. Minnesotans should be able to engage in legal sports betting right here in Minnesota, Stephen said. Really? We're going to get into vice here. And, you know, I've always said this, and the last time we talked about this was with the pull tabs and the stadium. And I said, you know, isn't it, it just, to me, do we always have to go in and legalize the vice? I mean, on one side, I mean, I kind of do believe. I've been in Vegas. I have gone to Vegas. I've been in the sports books out there. As a matter of fact, after walking around Vegas for a long period of time, I find it to be able to grab some food there and watch about 15 different, sporting events at the same time is actually quite entertaining. I only occasionally would throw a few dollars down on something. It wasn't really that big of a deal, but it was part of being in Vegas. You know, that's what you did. You gambled in Vegas. We in this state have had, I'll be the first to say it, some puritanistic mentalities. And we have talked over and over against about legalizing marijuana. For the record, I am for legalizing it because as far as if we're going to have vice, one that's actually one of the more milder vices and one that can make you a ton of taxpayer revenue, as they have seen in many states that have made it legal. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. I'm not saying I would legalize meth. I'm not saying I would legalize heroin. But if you've done any research on the medical impacts on people with marijuana, for the most part, actually it's a medicine for many people. And it is less dangerous than nicotine, and we still sell cigarettes. So it's kind of that mentality. But to a point, I'm a bit of a hypocrite by that stance. Because I look at that issue, even though, once again, it's not doing something new, it's not doing something more dangerous. It's kind of on the mindset of, I look at it as, if we're going to start dropping some of these vice standards, then I don't understand why marijuana is not one of them. But still today you get people who are, marijuana is the worst drug that ever existed that helps treat cancer. What was that again? Never mind. It's ludicrous on that level. But when it comes to when they brought the lottery on it, when they brought scratch tickets on it, when they looks like they're going to probably bring in legalized gambling, sports betting in this state. Because I really can't see how it's going to get stopped. I mean, I think there's enough people. This is one of those things where both sides of the aisle, whether they've been paid off or whether they just truly do believe that, you know, being able to, you know, for a suburban dad to be able to drop a 20 on the Lakers game that night is that big of a, you know, makes it even more exciting, especially when they come to foreclose. Yeah, I guess that's the case. But the reality is that we have a bad habit, I feel, as of just, okay, why not? Well, you know, because you're going to get a lot of gambling addicts. As much as you want to say, oh, there's no big deal, I mean, you yourself, when it's alcohol or cigarettes or gambling even, we put out we used to make, like, drinking. You used to make them say, don't drink and drive. You know, it's enjoy responsibly. Like, what the hell does that mean? Well, we didn't like having to say don't drink and drive because there's a lot of people that, you know, sure, they might make a bad choice, but that's not us. So they decided to drive to a bar and have a few beers and make us a few dollars. We can't judge too much, so we just say drink responsibly now. It's the slippery slope. And it's kind of one of those things where we're so down the slope now that I don't know if there's even really any, will there even be anybody saying, no, we shouldn't do it. I'm of the mindset, I guess that, you know, does everything have to be legal? I mean, like I said, at the end of the day, sure. Some 20-year-old guys, dudes, man, we want to put $20 down on the national championship college football game. Woo! Yeah, but there's also people who are out there putting $2,000 on that they had to pull every cent out of their house, out of their retirement account, out of their banking account, out of their checking and savings account to basically put a wager on because dad has been in a string of bad luck. Hopefully I'll come through tonight. I don't know. I mean, it is the benefit really outweigh the negative? I don't know if it does. And maybe that's the reason why I, you know, as much as a person could call me a hypocrite because of the marijuana thing, the reality is the benefit of legalizing marijuana outweighs any negativity. It doesn't really, it's not as addictive as nicotine. It's not as addictive as alcohol. It actually does have medical uses. And it generally, it doesn't lead to massive crime waves. And you generally don't have, you know, people who are horribly addicted. And I know there are people out there, Matt, let me show you the guy that's, he's 25 years old. He's still in his parents' basement. All he does is smoke dope all day. marijuana is not nearly as addictive as many other legal substances that are out there. For me, I look at the benefit. All right, if there's minimal addiction issues, if there's actual medical applications to it, and if we can make a ton of money on taxing it, well, the good there seems to outweigh the bad. Here, when it comes to sports gambling, I don't know if the good outweighs the bad. I mean, it's not like you can't make bets anyway and things. I mean, you want to bet your buddy $20, you can bet your buddy $20. It happens all the time. I mean, for goodness sakes, every spring we do an NCAA basketball tournament bracket. Everyone throws a bunch of money in the office and does these things, and no one bats an eye on that. So, I can see it from both sides. I can see it on one side. So, if they're already doing that, well, what's the big difference? But at the same time, the reality is there are a lot of people that get addicted, and a lot of people that, well, end up destroying their lives. As you call it harmless fun, there's a reason why these are called vices. They're addictive. And I've stopped trying to get in the way of the stuff at this point. All I can do is sit here and say, is it that going to be that long before we have someone saying, prostitution should be legal? I mean, there are some people already today that say this should be legal, and they can give you 1,000 points on why it should be. There'll people come on out that will say, do you really want to start regulating drug use? And I know people that's like, Matt, you're kind of trying to scare people away. No, we're on the slippery slope already. We went from, Powerball to, 20 other, near daily gambling with the lottery numbers, to scratch tickets, to pull tabs. We went all the way there, and now we're at the final stage. I mean, it's not, as far as it comes to sports betting, we're only just at the point where the end of the slide is. I also will say this, is that right now you're probably hearing what will probably be the only negative comments you will hear about it. And you don't exactly hear me saying, never in a million years should you pass this. I'm not exactly being negative. I just am, I kind of, one of these things is, do we have to do it? I mean, is the benefit outweigh the negative? And I don't think it does. I don't think the benefit of sports gambling does outweigh this, but I don't think the benefit of any of the gambling does. I really don't. So the question then comes down to whether or not, is it even worth our time to even say, should we do this? I can tell you right now, whether they are being bought and paid for already, or they're basically just enamored with the amount of money they will make from sports betting organizations and businesses in the future, I don't care which other side it is. The sports talk, the sports media in this town will not get in the way of this. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that they'll probably be cheering. I mean, I already know there's quite a few of them that are going to be cheering, and this is the greatest thing ever. They're either getting paid, or they're looking at the money down the line. And let's face it, these sports places, they don't want, someone like myself to do it. They want the sportscaster that everyone knows saying, hey, if you're going to gamble, gamble with these guys. So they're looking at the potential of revenue, the potential of money, and they don't really care about the fact that there are going to be people who are going to ruin, that this is going to ruin their lives. And sure, we give money to Gambling Anonymous, and we give money to Gambling Anonymous. Yeah, but you basically at the same time saying, hey, come in and gamble. By the way, don't gamble too much. Gamble responsibly, whatever that means. And then say, and we've given a small pittance of what we have to gambling addicts that have destroyed their lives. Hey, you'll have a hot meal that night. How about that? So I know, like I said, this is one of those issues. I'm with a lot of people. I'm probably on the other side of it, but I don't see the value here. But like I said, it's like Sunday liquor sales. You would have acted as if the issue was really, do you give up your firstborn child to be slaughtered in the public square? Considering how passionate people are about getting rid of you know, Sunday liquor sales. I mean, it was always funny to me. Sunday liquor sales was hilarious because it was the same people who were, you know, had no interest at all in any kind of political movement or anything. All of a sudden were it was the Lincoln frickin' Douglas debates. It was like, over the man of time have I wanted to get a drink on a Sunday. Should my quest for a beverage be hindered by an antiquated law? You know, you're like, Jesus, dude. And they got rid of it. The people that want this to happen, it's going to happen. And maybe one better way to look at it is not the fact that Minnesota will be the 33rd state to legalize betting, but there'll only be 17 other states left in the nation where if you want to try to avoid gambling, you'll have a better luck there. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I'm going to leave us on a bit of a sour note here at the end. Two things that I'm just amazed that the Democrats have not done a better job of utilizing to help their cause. The first is Anton Tony Lazaro. I mean, the latest story is a Minneapolis police officer helped move Anton Tony Lazaro to a new facility. The accused child sex trafficker offered up a chilling piece of information that he knew where the officer lived. It is one of the three instances U.S. District Judge Patrick Schlitz wrote this week where Lazaro suggested he could threaten and intimidate law enforcement officers as the federal case against him unfolded. And because of it, Schlitz ordered the former GOP operative must remain in custody while he awaits trial. Lazaro was indicted in August by federal grand jury on 10 counts related to child sex trafficking. It should be noted it was at in some capacity he was helping the former head of the Minnesota GOP, Jennifer Carnahan, run that organization in some capacity. He was for a while there, it seemed like he was her right-hand man. And there are lots of stories. We've already gone over that. I am flabbergasted that we do not hear more about this from the DFL. If this was the opposite, if the Democrats had someone like Anton Tony Lazaro had been tagging around with Ken Martin, oh my God, there would be hourly press releases, hourly posts on social media. Don't forget. And once again, the Democrats have taken this, well, that's an embarrassing story. We're going to just be on the standby and let them deal with it. Boy, oh boy, it sure is bad, isn't it? Destroy them with it, for God's sakes. You have a story here that of no making of your own. The Democrats cannot feel like this is anything that they have manufactured or exaggerated. My God, it is a disgusting story, and it entangles the entire Minnesota GOP in it. And you guys keep sitting back like, oh, I don't want to seem too aggressive. Freaking sweep the leg, Johnny. My God, go for the death blow. You guys, you know, the fact that this story is almost ignored by the DFL is an embarrassment. I mean, the Republicans would be using this with surgical precision to wipe out any topic or discussion the Democrats would want to talk about. They would be using it like a weapon. They would be absolutely derailing any kind of agenda for 2022. They would have the media constantly asking, what did you know and when did you know it, to every member. No, you guys fail horribly with this issue. And I know it's a sad, scary issue, but it's not your fault the Minnesota GOP went down that path. You need to do better there. Also, a group of Republican state lawmakers called the Minnesota School Boards Association to withdraw its membership from the National Association this week in light of controversial letters sent to the Biden administration. They faced widespread scrutiny over a letter wrote to President Joe Biden in September requesting help from federal law enforcement agencies to investigate and thwart threats and acts of violence made by community members against school boards across the country. The association likened such acts to a form of domestic terrorism and crimes. Now, this is, once again, the outrage that Republicans are having is made up. Because it's not, the critics denounced the letter for making an analogy, basically accused that if anyone was standing up at a school board meeting and saying, I'm against masks, that was wrong. That's not the case. We all know what these Republicans and these far right leaning loon balls have been saying. I know where you live. I'm going to kill your kids. I'm going to drink their blood. How dare you? How dare you try to teach about racism or demand a vaccine mandate or demand kids actually stay at home and remote learn? I will kill everyone in your family. That, which we have heard, that is what they're saying is like domestic terrorism, which it is. And as much as you guys want to downplay that and act like that hasn't existed, that has. And it has a lot. Ugh. I mean, you and Chaska have some far-right loon ball actually attacking a guy at a school board meeting. You've had threats made. You had this. I'm not saying you necessarily have to defend this letter, but let's make sure we understand something. This letter, the outrage about it is manufactured. Instead, you should be out there demanding that every Republican go on the record right now and say, I'm against threats of violence against school board members and teachers in our communities. Because you see, it's how Republicans haven't had to do that because they're out there screaming about this letter. This letter is right to call out threats. It's right to call out terrorist threats. And I don't care if it's being made by someone in a compound that's a white supremacist compound or Becky, who's part of the freaking PTO. A threat is a threat, and they should be treated that way. Republicans should have to ask the question, do you condone the violent threats against the school boards and the teachers? But they don't have to because the Democrats are so bad at managing messaging. They were, oh, God, yeah. Well, gee willikers. Yeah, I guess there was only a few people threatening to kill a teacher and the school board. I guess it was just a few. You guys got to do better. You guys got to do a lot better on your messaging. Native Roots Radio, they are coming up next. Have a fantastic weekend. We are back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.